I'm Kelly, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm glad to be here. Thank you for inviting me. I'm always glad to be at an AA meeting. Just a little nervous here, so bear with me. My sobriety date is July the 4th, 1998, and my home group is the Buckingham Big Book Group, and we meet on Tuesday night at 8 o'clock. So if you're ever down that way, we would love to have you come. And so let's see, with that out of the way, I'll just go ahead and start. I'm going to just share a little bit with you about what I used to be like and some of the things that happened and what I'm like now. And this is just my experience. So I'm not really speaking for AA as a whole. This is just whatever comes out is what I've prayed for God to show me and to say, and just my experience. So anyway, I'll just start with that I'm not originally from this area. I live in Lynchburg, Virginia now. I'm originally from Hampton, Virginia Beach area. That's where I was born and raised. And I've been in Lynchburg now, I guess, about 20 years. I have a son that's 27. He lives in Florida. I'm getting ready to be a grandma there for the first time in November. And I'm married. Got married for the first time 5 years ago. Never had been married. I was single mom for a long time. Got six sisters, and three of us, my mom and dad, divorced when I was real young, and three of them went to live with my dad, and me and two others lived with my mom, and she worked as a waitress to try to raise us. And she remarried another man, which I'm told was, you know, because I was the only child there for a while till they had two, that he was a good man and doted over me and all like that. And I don't really recall a lot of that. But there was a lot of things that went on as I was growing up in that household. And I don't know if he was alcoholic or not. But he died an alcoholic death, and I'll talk about that later. But coming up in my household with my mom working and this stepfather, and none of this makes me alcoholic. I'm just trying to tell you a little bit about me. But anyway, my mom worked a lot. I babysitted my younger sisters a lot, and my stepfather would work once in a while, and sometimes he wouldn't, and he drank a lot, and he would come home, and he would argue and fight with my mom, and it was very scary growing up in that home like that. We never knew what was going to go on, and I've seen my mom go to work with black eyes and stuff, and I just used to always, from about 8 years old up, just have this fear. I just was filled with fear. Just never, you know, just didn't want him to come home because I knew what it would be like, and it was just, you know, my stomach would just be in knots and just be in fear of him coming home. And my granny used to come and stay with us a lot when we were younger so she could watch us for my mom to work, and my granny's no longer with us, but it was always comforting to have her there because when she was there, he would sort of seem to stay gone longer. He didn't, him and my grandmother, he just, you know, because he just wouldn't come around when she was there, and I used to love it when she'd be there. She'd sleep with me at night and rub my back, and it just, I felt secure when she was there. So anyway, I just grew up in this household and started going to school, and all this stuff was going on, and just full of fear. And long before I ever took a drink, I can remember just always not wanting to come home from school, not wanting to be in that house, just you know, would always want to spend the night with other kids and do other stuff, just didn't want to come home. I didn't want to be around him and all the stuff that would go on. And I had two younger sisters that was probably 4 and 5 and 4 or 5 years old and 7 years old. And it was kind of like my job to keep him quiet back in the bedroom when he would come home. And just, you know, it was just terrifying. So, and my mom would leave. She's originally from Lynchburg, and she'd go back and forth to Lynchburg and take him back and go back. And so we'd do all this traveling up and down the road on the Greyhound bus, and then she'd always go back. And I used to just hate it when we would have to go back. You know, I just couldn't understand why she would always take him back and go back, and we'd be in that kind of environment. So, I remember from a very early age, I just couldn't wait to get out of that house. And I had a cousin come and spend the night with me one time. I guess I was probably about 11, almost 12 years old. And she had come down to visit some relatives, and she had spent the night. And she was a good cousin, and we were the same age, and she was there, and we were having fun. And then he came in on one of those escapades. And we didn't have a telephone at our house. There was a 7-Eleven up on the corner. And, you know, all this stuff would start and the arguing and everything. And she got scared. Of course she'd get scared. And she wanted to go home. And I remember crying and asking her not to go and not to leave me. And it'll be all right. And she was like, no. So I put her out of the window. And we went up to the 7-Eleven. And she called someone to come and get her up, pick her up. And they did. And from that moment on, I hated him. I hated my mom. I hated where I was at. That was just one of the times something kind of broke. So anyway, I guess when I was about in the seventh grade, I probably had took sips of alcohol. I'm sure I did. I always hung out with older kids and kids that hung out in the woods and did all of that stuff, and started going to this middle school or junior high school, and back then it was the 7th, 8th, and 9th grade. And I was a good kid in school, but I never seemed to fit in. You know, kids can be really cruel, and, you know, I never had the right clothes, never had the right shoes, didn't have what seemed like the other kids had, and I just didn't seem to fit in anywhere there. And then along came this older group of kids, and, you know, they were kind of like the popular ones, even though they seemed to be in trouble, and they invited me to go out back of the school at lunchtime, me and another girl. And I didn't know what they were doing in the woods, but I wanted to go. I had been invited, and I just wanted to be a part of that. And so we went. And it was three other guys and me and a girl, and they had stolen some Mad Dog 2020 and some Boone's Farm up at a drugstore, and they were back there, and we were huddled around in a little circle, and they passed it around, and I just, when it got to me, I just started drinking it, not sipping it, but just kind of chug-a-lugging it. And I remember the guy said, he just pulled it away from me, and he said, if you want more, you just go steal your own. And what I felt that I remember yesterday, like yesterday, was I felt accepted. When that alcohol hit my body, it felt warm all over. I remember it like yesterday. And that fear that was in my gut went away. It went away, and I just felt okay, and I felt a part of, and it was just great. And, you know, we laughed and just had a good time. And I came home sometime that evening sick, hickey on my neck, had smoked some other stuff and cigarettes and the alcohol, and got home, and I was sick as a dog. And my stepfather, you know, kept telling my mom, she's been drinking, blah, 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 and all of this. And I was like, no, it was just something I eat. And I told him I fell off the bicycle into a rose bush, and that's why I had the hickey. And I was puking over the toilet, all of this red stuff. And, you know, can remember to this day saying, I'll never do that again. God, if you just let me, you know, the dry heaves, the everything. And I remember it clearly. It was a Wednesday. I stayed home from school on Thursday, sick as a dog. And Friday morning, I couldn't wait to get to that school to get up with those kids. Because it was just like I just felt like I belonged. I don't know, but I couldn't wait to get up with them again. And that's how I started out my drinking. So, you know, in that one day's time, you know, skipped the rest of the school, started the drinking, all of that stuff. And I just love doing that. And like I said, I always hung out with older people that had cars and they could buy the booze. And we'd just skip school and we'd ride around and, you know, we'd go into these bars, honky-tonk bars, whatever you call it. I wasn't even old enough to go into them and play pool, and they'd drink, and it was just like I thought I had arrived. I was just really, really cool, but I was really, really a kid, and I was putting myself in circumstances that older people are in that I couldn't measure up to. You know, I would go so far, and then I couldn't, and it was just, you know, I was just really in over my head, but it didn't matter. I didn't care as long as I wasn't at that house. Anyway, you know, my stepfather would leave at times, and my mom would continue to work, and I would I would skip school, I would run away, I would stay out all night. And the only thing that seemed to make me feel better was the alcohol and that other stuff. And I don't want to talk a lot about that because I did those other things, you know, smoking the pot, whatever. But I never, and this is just my experience, I never did those other things unless I was drinking first. The drink was, you know, there, and then whatever else came along was okay. And towards the end of my drinking, you know, when all of that was gone, the alcohol was always still there. And so I know that for me, if I don't pick up a drink today, I'm not going to go out here and pick up something else. And that's just my experience. So I know that I'm an alcoholic. I'm not an addict, or I'm not any of those other things. I'm a person that cannot drink safely. And I didn't find that out till after I'd gotten into AA and had been here over a year and a half of just not drinking and going to meetings. But back when I guess I was 13, I want to speed it up. I don't really want to talk about, but when I was going to school, you know, if you skip school and you were beyond parental control, the truant officers came after you and stuff. And I was getting to where, you know, I wouldn't come home, I wouldn't go to school, and so my mom, we had to go to court, and I had to go up and spend some time in a place called Bon Air Detention Center up in Richmond, and it's a detention center for girls. So I stayed up there for a while because I couldn't follow the authority of anybody. My mother, my father, the law, I had no respect for it. I had this thing in my mind that I was just going to do whatever I wanted to do to get whatever it is I wanted, and I didn't care what you thought or what anybody else thought. And I lived like that all the way up to 36, 37 years old. And, and even sometimes today I can still be rebellious and, you know, still think sometimes I'm above authority, whatever that may mean, in my job and in AA and my home, or, you know, because I think that I know everything sometimes and I don't. You know, it's not until I'm in a lot of pain and a lot of turmoil that I'll turn around and surrender. I know I'm jumping ahead from me, you know, around and stuff, but I believe there's many surrenders in this program. Putting down alcohol is one of them, but it's a lot of others that come. And so I'm still experiencing all of that. When I was 16, I quit school and was living with some people down in Hampton, and my mother was still up here. And I had fake IDs, and I was going into bars, and she let me stay with this friend of hers that had kids my age, and that friend didn't really care what we did, you know, but my mom didn't know that, and so I loved that. And we would hitchhike rides, and we'd go to after-hour bars, and we'd go to clubs over in Norfolk, and it was just great. And I just love the bar life. I'm a bar fly. I don't know much about sitting at home drinking alone, but I like to be out in the bar, around people. I can't be by myself. I think that's one of my problems. See, I can't just sit at home and be by myself. So I want to be out and going and doing, and just, I'm just crazy like that. And So I got with some people, and that's what we did. And I would hang out with these older Navy guys and women, and we'd go to after-hour bars, and we'd have a good time. And then we'd all stay in motels and sleep all day and just would party all night. And each time we'd go to the bar one night, one of us girls would figure out how we were going to get the money to get a room to stay there the next day. So we'd get some of these guys and tell them whatever or promise them whatever, and we'd get money from them. And sometimes we would lure them outside, and some of these other guys would beat the crap out of them, and they'd take their money. And I'm not proud of that. That's just what I do when my self-will is run riot. I'm going to do anything I can to get what I need, to buy whatever it is I need to make Kelly feel good at the time. And that's what we would do. And I'm making an amends today to some of those people financially, you know. But that's what we would do. And when I look back on it now, sometimes it's kind of hard to believe that I was that kind of person. But, I mean, I was that kind of person. I just didn't care. I didn't care about myself. I didn't have no self-respect. I came through life figuring that life had dealt me a bad hand. My dad, once he remarried and was over in Virginia Beach and had a new family and these other girls, and we lived with my mom. He was a very strict military man, and I felt like he didn't want anything to do with me, and we were real strained and apart, and my mom had to work a lot, and it left a lot of free time for me to pretty much run wild, and that's what I did. So anyway, living over there in Norfolk, I was driving someone's car one time. I was driving somebody's car, and I ran into the back of someone down there on Little Creek Road. I got out, left the car in the middle of the road, ran, and got money to take the bus back up to Lynchburg, where my mom was, and just fled the scene of that accident. Never did get caught. And still to this day, I've never seen the guy that owned that car to be able to try to make that right, but I have found another way through the program to be able to do that. So I come up to Lynchburg, and I'm 16, almost 17, and so my mom's living up there, and I just figured I'll just try to live in Lynchburg and process. You know, I met this man, and I ended up getting pregnant, and he didn't want to get married, and he had no idea, you know, about a kid, and he thought it was just going to be me and him trying to make it, and blah, 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 and so anyway, there I was, 17, pregnant, not married, no education. And after I had enough of that for a little while, me and my mom and the whole family moved back to Hampton, and I had my son. So, you know, I'm starting that whole cycle up. So I lived down there till my son was almost five. And during this time, all I did was bartend once in a while, waitress, and I got welfare checks and food stamps and money anywhere that I could get it to support us and to support my drinking. And my mom would watch my son, and I'd stay out all night long, and I'd come in at 6 in the morning and sleep, and it was just a big cycle, you know. And I thought, well, my son's getting ready to turn 5. I really want to have a stable life for him. I want to be a good mom. So I moved to Lynchburg, and I moved back to Lynchburg where his father is, because he promised me if I came back up there that he'd be a father to my son, and, you know, and all of this stuff. So I thought, you know, my kid's getting ready to start school. I need to be in a more laid-back place and just, you know, try to start over, and he can see his father. And that worked out for about 3 or 6 months. And when he found out I didn't want to have nothing to do with him anymore, then that's when he quit coming around as far as my son. So there I was in Lynchburg and raising this little boy. And my aunt took care of him a whole lot, my mother's sister. And I just did the same thing. bartended and started meeting people in Lynchburg. And when I came up there, you know, I came from like a disco type of thing to redneck pool playing country music. You know, I'm going to find people like me that like to drink and do all of this stuff. So I just kind of started doing what they did, and I was just really, really sick, and you know, and I'm drinking every day at this point. Maybe not a whole lot, but my drinking would be like I would get up and I would have maybe a beer and tomato juice, and then by lunchtime I would have some wine, and then by the evening time I would have liquor. And then when I wanted to stay out all night long, those other things would come into play. And then when I'd get home and I couldn't go to sleep, then I would take Valium or something. So I was just on this merry-go-round, and that was it. I mean, that was just it. And I also, during this period, had made up my mind that my son was not going to want for nothing, that he was going to have the right shoes. He was going to go to the same school. I went to 4 different schools one time when I was in the 4th grade. And let me tell you, in the 4th grade, and you go to 4 new schools, and you're the new kid, you get picked on a lot. You know, you just can't stand it. And I just made my mind up that my son was not going to be like me, that he'd go to one school, middle school, elementary, middle, and high school, and he did. And he was going to have whatever it was that he needed to have, and he did. But it wasn't because that I worked honestly to give it to him. It's because I took the charity of others, the welfare of people, and the money of men and whatever. But it wasn't because Kelly worked or got anything the right kind of way. But and he's turned out to be a pretty good kid considering where he grew up from. But so that's what I did. And then I started back in, from 82 up to 97, I started getting a lot of DUIs. I think that I've had 5 DUIs, and I've been convicted of 3 of them, and the others got thrown out. I was always drinking, driving on a suspended license. I'd go to North Carolina, I'd give an address down there of a friend. I'd get a driver's license down there because they didn't go by your social security number. They went by another number. And I'd drive on those Carolina tags, and when I'd get stopped or go through a road check, I'd just tell people I was in school, and that just kept going on and on until finally that caught up with me and they realized I really wasn't in school and that I just lived in Lynchburg. And, you know, I just started going to jail. Started going to jail for a couple days here, a weekend there, 2 weeks here, because of my either getting a DUI or going through a road check, being on a suspended driver's license. And my son would stay with my aunt or my mom or somebody while I would be there, and they never told him where I was at. And I just lived to get up every morning, to have whatever it was I needed to get through that day, and to take care of my kid, and to not have to feel, to not be responsible, to not just, you know, I just, that's just how I lived for a long time. When my son was about 12, we moved to this house. And I was seeing this married man, and he was supplying everything that I needed. And he bought this house, and we lived there, and it was just great. It was just great because I had money, and I had alcohol, and we'd go to a lot of bars, and we'd go to out of town, and it was just great. And, you know, I mean, whatever it was I wanted, he would give it to me. And one morning I woke up and I got a call from this person, and he asked me to, you know, meet him down at one of the restaurants he owned in Lynchburg. So I did, dropped my son off at the middle school, went down there and met him. And the next thing I found myself was down there in downtown Lynchburg on these railroad tracks next to the foundry, and he was beating my head in on the dash asking me why did I tell his wife? Someone had told his wife, and I didn't know what he was talking about. And it was about 9 o'clock in the morning. And so he pulled this truck over, and, you know, people are going back and forth to work, and, you know, he's kicking me, and he goes and gets this little brown paper bag and pulls this gun out on me. And, you know, at this point, I'm just really thinking, yeah, this is it. And I can remember literally being down on my knees with my hands up, and I begged him not to shoot me, that I had a son, you know, up in school. And he said, I don't give a crap about your son. I got a 5-year-old daughter that found a note on my car and brought it into her mom, and I don't care. My wife is leaving, and I don't care. And I didn't do it. And it was just, that went on. I don't know how long it went on, but, you know, of course, I'm standing here today, and he said, no. He said, I'm not going to do anything. He said, go on up and walk to the police station. It'll be the last walk that you ever make. And he left me down there, and I had 2 cracked ribs. It's 9 o'clock in the morning. I'm trying to get myself up off the ground, and I'm trying to flag down somebody to carry me up to my car, and this man stopped, carried me up there, and then I passed out on the sidewalk, and they took me to the hospital. And I remember staying with my aunt for a couple of weeks because I was scared to go home. And, of course, everybody said, you can't go back to that house. You can't do this. You can't do that. And I was like, well, let's don't take this too far now. I mean, that's my house. I can go back to it, you know. And I still, you know, I still, because I'm greedy. And I don't want to pay no rent. And I don't care what you do to me. And you're almost killing me. And I'm still going to live in that house because you owe me something. I'm, you know, I'm putting my son's life at jeopardy. I'm doing all this stuff because I don't want to be responsible and do the right thing. And when I look back on that now, it could have really been, it could have turned out a whole lot worse than what it did. But that's what my ego and my selfishness and self-centeredness wanted to do at the time. And so I did. I moved back into that house, and I kept drinking. And he didn't come around for a while. And I started working at the Elks Lodge as a bartender, and I got really drunk one night, and I had this neighbor that lived a couple doors down, and I was running out of money and wasn't making a lot of tips, and for whatever reason, I stole a couple of checks from my neighbor, and I wrote them. I wrote them in somebody else's name, and this person cashed them, and we split the money, and then I went off to Myrtle Beach for a spree. And when I came back, I had detectives at the door from the bank and from the police where they had turned me in. And went to court on that, and they gave me 2 years penitentiary time, and they suspended that and put me on 18 months probation. And my son didn't know about that. So I kept working at the Elks Lodge and just kept drinking. And I'd go out at night, and my son would get himself off to school every morning. He's a very good student. He'd get himself up, go to school. And I can't help sometimes, and I'm okay with it now. It's just overwhelming. But I can't help but how many times maybe he got up to get water or go to the bathroom and realized I wasn't there. But I'd come back in at 5 or 6 and get in the bed and act like I'd been there all night long. And he never would say anything. But I know he must have knew that I wasn't there. My lawyer told me one time, you know, Kelly, you're real, real good at hiding stuff. You know, you only tell me just enough. And he said, but, you know, there's going to come a place in time when I'm not going to be able to get you out of trouble. You know, the evidence is going to be there, and so many DUIs, and the laws have changed that it's mandatory now, regardless of what a judge wants to do. They have to give you a certain amount of whatever, you know. And he would just, you know, you got such a good son, and, you know, I see potential in you. And I'd get decent jobs every now and then. I'd had a job one time at the Ford company and sold a truck, and my mom had been there visiting. My son told my mom, you know, how proud he was of his mom dressing up to go to work. And then, you know, because I would go to the bar that night and stay out all night, I couldn't make it to my job the next day, so I wouldn't have a job. And, you know, he couldn't understand that. I couldn't understand why I kept doing it either. You know, it wasn't until I got here to AA that I realized that once I take a drink, it produces a physical craving in me. I mean, it starts in my mind, but when I take that alcohol into my body, for me, it produces a craving where I'm going to want to have another one. And once I have another one and then another one, I don't know if I'm coming home that night. I don't know if I'm going to steal from you. I don't know what I'm going to do. I have no idea. Most of the time, it's not good. And, you know, most of the time, it's not good. I'm really a sick person. I know, you know, because I'm so selfish and self-centered, you know. And so anyway, my life was really, really unmanageable. I never knew it was really due to alcohol. But after getting here and doing an inventory and taking a look back, when I look back at one of our trips up here when I was like 13 and I was with some people and they let me drive their car. It was one of those older Camaros with a stick shift. And we were at a stop sign and I was going to turn left and there was a graveyard and a telephone post. And I guess the clutch popped too quick and the car kind of jumped and I went over into the telephone pole. Broke my nose and everything. When I look back, and this is for me, when I look back on everything that's happened to me, I've been under the influence of alcohol all the way up. I was always under the influence of something. But I just figured that the law had it in for me. When I got to AA, I thought that the cops literally sat outside and watched for Kelly to drive. I would peep out the windows. It was a very paranoid feeling to get up and have to look out the window. But see, all of that was just my conscience because I know that I was doing wrong, you know. So, of course, you know, I'm going to think when I'm doing wrong and I'm not living by the laws of God and man, I'm going to have that and I'm going to be looking, you know. And it couldn't just be that maybe when I drove and I couldn't drive a lick and I was all over the road that the police would stop me. That couldn't be it. No, they just waited because they had it in for Kelly, you know. My stepmom, that's got about 38 years in this program, told me a long time ago when I was about 12 or 13 that you think this world owes you something. And I really did. She hit the nail on the head. And she said, this world don't owe you anything. There are a lot of people worse off than you, and they don't do these things. You know, the reason that this is going on is because you can't control your drinking. And you do strange and crazy things, like the Jekyll and Hyde in the book that it talks about in there and that I can't quote, you know, that sometimes we're okay with respect to other things, but let me take alcohol into my system, and I become very antisocial. I am very antisocial. And I can see me all over here, and I didn't start reading this till a couple years into sobriety, but I'm all in these pages. Well, anyway, so on my last, you know, so my life has really been unmanageable for a very long time, and I'm just hanging on by a thread, and I'm trying to raise my son, and, you know, and got this probation officer, and I'm still driving to work as a bartender at the Elks Lodge. Now, my son's 17. I got this Camaro, and I put it in his name because when he graduates, I'm going to give it to him. But you can't drive it. I'm still going to drive it to work. I mean, I'm just, you know, manipulating like that. So I went to work one night. I got off about 4 o'clock, and I had been dating this man that came in there once in a while, and he's not one of us. He would come in because you can play poker there, and he'd come in and he would have a drink, very, very social, and he'd come in and play poker, and we started dating each other. And I got off from work one night, and this other man that was there, you know, had known him before and had knew about this girl he had dated. And I'm sitting there having a couple drinks, and this other guy is telling me about this girlfriend that my now husband used to have and all of this stuff. So I go, now this is what I do. I have a couple drinks, I leave, I go home, put these workout clothes on, and I go and I work out with a buzz. I come back, I make this big spaghetti dinner because he's coming over for dinner. But see, when I drink, I get to talking a lot. And all I kept talking about, well, what about this Lyndon? Lyndon, blah, 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 and Lyndon. You know, he's like, Kelly, I'm not talking to you about that tonight. I'm going home. You stay here. You know I told you that was a long time ago, blah, 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 blah. And I'm just going on and on. And he said, I'm not hearing it tonight. I'm not having it. I'll just talk to you tomorrow. And I said, well, what about the spaghetti? He said, I don't give a crap about the spaghetti. I'm going home. So when he left out, my brain said, I will fix you. And so there I am with sweatpants on, a halter top, hair up in a ponytail, and a black leather jacket. I go out and I get in the car, and I went and picked up this other person, and we went to a bar in Lynchburg, and $68 tab, tequila shooters, Coors Light, playing pool, and somehow along the night I lost him somewhere. I don't know why. It might have been because I was a little obnoxious, because I get loud and obnoxious in a bar, and left from there at 2 o'clock, and my mind said, I wonder who he has at his house, because I know probably that Linda's over there. So I drive by this townhouse that he lived in. Lights are all off. Nobody's there. And I get on Lakeside Drive, and I'm going down the road, and I hear, woo, woo, woo. And I'm like, I just like, you know, when you hear that behind you, you really do kind of sober up pretty quick, or a lot of things start flashing in front of you. And what started flashing in front of me is, oh, God, you know, this is another DUI. I'm on probation. If I get down to this quickie before he can get me and get out of the car, he can't get me for a DUI. So I'm racing down to this quickie store, and I get out of the car, and I'm acting like I'm going into the store, and he tapped me on my shoulder and told me to come back to the car, and I just knew it was over then. I just knew that, you know, that, I mean, this is just not good, and, you know, he had me do all them field sobriety things, put me in the back of the car, and I begged, and I pleaded, and I cried, and I told him, I said, look, I cannot get another DUI. I cannot afford anything. Can we just work this out? Can we just work it out? And he was like, if you don't shut up, I'm going to write you up for something else. I just started boo-hooing even more. So there I am at the police station one more time, and I called my son to come get me, which is many times I've had to call him to come and get me. And, you know, he had a job at this Chick-fil-A, and I just want to just say this. He had this job at Chick-fil-A. He started when he was 14, and he stayed there until he got a scholarship to go to Old Dominion. And the people that worked there were so supportive of him because he had one friend there that would always come with him. And they would drive him down so that he could pick me up and get the car out of impoundment. And they never, to my knowledge, have ever said anything bad about me to him. So anyway, that morning he came down there and got me. And we came home. And as soon as we got home, I needed a drink, and there was about that much wine left in a bottle in the refrigerator, and as soon as I got in there, I took that bottle and I turned it up, and he looked at me and he said, Mama, what are you doing? I just come and got you. And I said, Ryan, don't worry about it. I had phone book out, I'm looking around, because I'm calling the lawyer. I'm always calling the lawyer, and I said, everything's going to be okay. And he just looked, and he just shook his head with disgust and went out. And now, I know, I didn't know then, but I know today the reason I needed that alcohol was because I had a lot of alcohol in my system already when I went to jail. And I physically needed that drink. It wasn't that I just wanted to drink, to show you, to hurt you. I needed a drink. And so I drank that, called a lawyer, and all of that started. And talked to my probation officer, and he told me, he said, well, if you're found guilty of this felony DUI, I'm going to have to revoke your probation here, and you'll probably get the 2 years plus whatever they want to do you on this. And I am just like, I mean, this is just really, really bad. And so what do? I still keep drinking. I'm still working at that Elks Lodge, and I'm still driving that car. And one night after I got off from work, because I was like the nighttime manager, I thought, how can I get out of this? What can I do? Well, there was another guy that came into that club that I hadn't talked about before, but he was one of us here in the program, and he didn't drink And before I got this last DUI, he had come up to me, and I don't know why, but he had come up to me and he said, "Kelly, me and my wife would love to take you to an AA meeting sometime if you'd like to go." And I looked at him and I was like, "Well, I don't think I need that right now." And then later on, I'm on Channel 6 again and another DUI. So I'm sitting there and I had this drink that night and I'm thinking, and his name came into mind, and I thought, this AA thing. So I got out the phone book and I called the AA 24-hour line, hotline. And I got this woman on the phone, and I told her all of my woes and everything and what had happened and how much trouble I was in. And I needed to come to this AA thing because I needed help in front of the judge, you know. It wasn't because I was surrendered by no means. I was not surrendered when I got here, and I don't think that that matters. I think if you stay here and you find out you're one of us, that that's the main thing. But I did not walk in, seeing the light, surrendered. No more alcohol, no more craving or nothing. That's just not my experience. I didn't have that. So she said, "Well, if you feel the same way in the morning, I'll come pick you up for a meeting." So I was hungover. I come to about 9:15. This meeting was about 10 o'clock. And I was like, "Oh, man, I got to call this woman. I got to get to this meeting because they're going to help me out. I got to do it, you know." So I pulled myself together, and I called her, and she came and picked me up. And we went down to my first meeting was 10 o'clock morning then. It was called the Oz meeting down at the Salvation Army, which is the gateway now for men in Lynchburg. And she has this really southern whiny voice, you know. And she kept talking to me about what I was going to have to lose in order to gain. And I was like, "I ain't having none of that. I'm just, you know, all I need to know is how to drink safely without suffering the consequences. That's all I wanted to do when I got here. I wanted to learn how to drink without suffering consequences." And we got down there to that meeting. There's three guys outside of that meeting. And I looked at that place and I was like, "Oh, no, I don't fit in here. I know I don't fit in here." And, you know, one was a biker-looking guy and two other guys and downtown. And when I got out of the car, she introduced me to these guys. One had about a year. One had a few months, one had 3 years, and they were all laughing and having a good time, and I was sick, literally sick, crying, shaking, and they were telling me it was going to be all right, and let's go get coffee, and blah, 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 and I was like, "But what about, you know," and they were like, it's going to be all right, let's just go inside and get, you know, get coffee," and they were just laughing about all of this really bad stuff in there. They were all laughing and stuff, and I was just like, "Man, this is just not good," you know. And we went in there and we sat down at this table, and all I can tell you about that meeting is I didn't hear a lot what you shared, but I let out a breath that lasted, I know, that whole hour of just, and I just, and that was just pretty much it. And when that meeting was over, somebody asked me to go to another one that night. And I didn't want to, but I was too scared to be alone. I came here out of fear, out of not wanting to go to jail, and just wanting y'all to show me how I could still drink safely. But I can tell you today that if I'd have went to that meeting and those guys hadn't have reached out their hand, and I hadn't have got that safe feeling, and everybody in that room needed a meeting, and it was all about problems, I don't know, but I probably wouldn't have come back. So I really think it's very important that we try to reach out and just comfort and welcome someone in, because we never know who that's going to touch in whatever kind of way. Because that is what got me to another meeting. And when people come to my home group or whatever meeting that I'm at, I do want to go up and introduce myself. I do want to talk to people. I do want to make them feel at home. I don't want to be huddled over here in a group like at some groups that I see and people coming in and out and nobody acknowledges them, you know, because that might be what they're seeing when they first come in. And I don't want to be like that. So I try to welcome other people. Anyway, I started coming to AA, like they would ask me to come to meetings, and I'd go. And my experience with meetings was I could not sit down. I couldn't stay seated in a chair the whole hour. And I would try, but I couldn't. I would get up, I would get down. And this is just my experience. Thank God nobody threw me out because of that. Because I just couldn't. I physically could not sit in a chair. So, yes, I was one getting the coffee, going to the bathroom, up and down. You know, and the meetings that I was going to, nobody told me that that was wrong or bad or whatever. You just, you know, they just kept saying, don't take a drink, keep coming back, you know. And that's just what I heard early on, and that's just what I did. About 3 days before I had to go to court, I needed to tell my son about all the trouble that I was in. Y'all had told me in the program I needed to do that. I might not be coming back on Friday, and he didn't know about a lot of the stuff. So I asked him, and I told him about the probation. I told him about everything, and at this time my lawyer hadn't had nothing worked out, hadn't done nothing. It was a Wednesday. I was going to court Friday, and I told my son about all this stuff. And, you know, at this point my family, nobody is having nothing to do with me. I mean, I really felt very much alone except for the people in AA, you know, that were there for me. And I asked my son, I said, do you think if they send me somewhere Friday, you know, and he's looking at all this stuff that I've been telling him about, and I said, do you think you might would come visit me wherever I'm at? And he looked at me and he said, Mama, I got to do what I got to do for me, and you got to do what you got to do for you. And he was holding back tears and he left. And when he walked out, something inside of me just clicked, and I felt like I was suffocating. I felt like I could not breathe. When Bill talks about how quicksand stretched all around and he had met his match, which I had with alcohol, you know, I just, all in one moment, all these thoughts started going through my head. Well, you know, now I don't have my son. I got this car out there. I'm not going to court. I'm not going to jail. I'm not doing none of this. I'll just run. I'll just leave. Just everything started happening to me. And in that same instance, I don't know why, but I dropped to my knees next to my sofa, and I just said, God, help me. And I didn't say, if you do this, I'll do that. I just said, help me. And when I got up, I don't know why I didn't go out in the car to do all that stuff, but I went in and I called this girl that had been taking me to meetings. She don't no longer come anymore. But she had about 4 years of sobriety, and I called her, and she came, and she sat with me until about 4 o'clock that morning, when I so desperately needed a drink, and I didn't take one, and she just sat with me and listened and was just there. And I really, really appreciate that, because I don't know what I would have done. And I don't know why God gave me that moment of clarity to pick up a phone, because I'm not one to pick up a phone when everything else is saying, go do this. I don't know. I don't know why. I don't question it. But I did do that in sincerity, and then the next day I got a call, and my felony got reduced to a misdemeanor, and so I didn't get violated for my probation. I did get 4 months in jail. I did go to jail, and while I was sitting in Lynchburg City Jail, I got off of probation. That whole thing could have went the other way around. When I went to court, instead of having the same criminal judge I always have, I had a civil court judge up there that I'd never met, and everything that my lawyer asked for, the man went along with. And I even got to get a furlough to go to my son's graduation because I was in jail, and they let me out at 5, come back at 10 that night. And there's a lot of people that I know today, because I take meetings into jail and I'm around a lot of people that do that. They don't get to even get out to go to a relative's funeral. I don't know why that was given to me, you know, and I'm not saying that if you're that way, that's going to be your experience. That's just my experience. So, that's what happened, and I had a big book in there, and I was able to call. We didn't have any AA meetings in there, and when I got out, and the heat was off, and I was out of jail, and everything was okay, I went to Myrtle Beach on the 4th of July weekend, and I drank again. So without a solution, without a mental defense, and I'm out of trouble, and somebody hands me a drink, my natural instinct is to take it, and that's what I did. Then I came back to Lynchburg and went to a pool tournament to drink Coke. Somebody handed me a beer, and I drank it. But this time, on the fourth beer, I pushed it away and had a moment of clarity again. I guess God gave that to me. And I came to myself, and I said, you know, look at what you're doing. You're drinking when you don't want to drink. And I pushed it away. I didn't have no buzz, and I walked all the way home, and I cried all the way home, and I knew I was done. I knew that I was done. I knew that I was powerless over alcohol. I knew my life was unmanageable. I knew that, and I went to my home group at that time and picked up a white chip. And then that really started my recovery, started my journey in recovery. And since then, it's been a real, real wild ride. And I don't have enough time to really talk about it, but I came to AA for about a year and a half of not drinking and going to meetings. And I was full of rage and full of fear. When you talked about God, I'd cuss you out and I'd leave this meeting. And people still told me to keep coming back. I mean, it was really, really bad because I couldn't. I was so full of guilt and shame, and I just couldn't go to those meetings where they talked about God a lot. But I just kept coming. And there'd be a couple people outside of the meeting asking me if I had a sponsor. They were asking me what step was I on. They were asking me how long did I want to stay sick. They were asking me what did I want to do. I didn't want to do nothing. But, I knew that it was going to come a point in time where I was going to really just throw the towel in on this thing and just give it up and drink if I didn't do something. Because I thought, I knew I believed in some sort of higher power out there because I'd been saved over and over, and I knew I was powerless on alcohol. But I got screwed up with that third step because I thought that that meant my perception. That's what's wrong with me anyway, is my perception. And I thought that that meant that I had to go to church every day and I had to not smoke again and I had to not do all of this stuff and I had to preach and I had to be this real, real good person that I knew inside I was not. And so when I shared this with a person, they said, oh, no, that's not what that means. That just means that you know that there is something out there bigger and stronger than you, and you're just going to allow that power to help you. Do you have the willingness to do that much? And I said, yeah. And they said, okay, we're going on to the fourth step. And we got on our knees in that parking lot, and she said the third step prayer with me, and I mumbled it behind her, but then we went on. And that's how it's been. Now, my relationship with my God today is more than that, but that's what it took in the very, very beginning. And if I don't have y'all here to show me that, to tell me your experience, and I think that I'm on my own here trying to do this, and I think it means this and that, I'm going to get stuck, and I'm probably going to leave because I'm not like you, and I can't do it. Even though I want to, I'm probably not going to be able to do it. Just started going to a lot of meetings. I'm a person that needs a lot of meetings. I probably go anywhere 5 to 7 meetings today. My sponsor tells me that Alcoholics Anonymous is a buffer between me and the outside world. I need a lot of meetings because I'm very high strung. And I, you know, when stuff is going on here, if I can get to a meeting or talk to one of y'all, it tones me down a notch. The problem may not be gone, but I see things in a clearer way a little bit. I get a little bit more of the solution to be able to put one foot in front of the other and keep going on. And that's what I do. Got very involved in service, made the coffee at the home group, didn't really want to do it, but I was just at the point where I couldn't be by myself and I didn't know what to do. So when y'all started asking me to do these things and I would see other people that had done some of these things and they weren't living that life anymore and they were happy and I wanted what they had, I started like doing some of the things that they did. And we now have AA meetings in the institutions in Lynchburg, and that came about because me and someone else, you know, went forward to try to get those going, because I could have probably used one when I was in there at the time and we didn't have any. So I'm very active in corrections work. I really don't consider myself as one of those people, because I am one of those people. And at our AA meeting in our facility, it is one alcoholic sharing with another, or at least that's what I hope it is, and I'm just like them. I'm not somebody coming on the outside to preach to do any of that. I'm just saying that I've sat here before. I've experienced some of these things. And if you want what we have and you think alcohol is your problem, you know, maybe when you get out, if you call, get to a meeting, start doing some of these things, maybe you can get free. I know of men and women that are in prison that are never getting out, that are never getting out. And they are sponsoring people, they're carrying the message inside, and they are free. They are totally free, even with the fact that they're never getting out. That is awesome. And they're carrying it to young men and women that will have a chance to get out. I mean, that is really awesome. That is just like, I can't even, and that's not been my experience, but I can't imagine why I'd want to do anything like that for you when I ain't never getting out. You know, that's just, it's just, but this thing works, you know. This Alcoholics Anonymous has saved my life. Everything that's good and decent in my life due to, by coming to that meeting, just manipulating and still conning. Because I got there, and then slowly but surely, y'all showed me a way that I want more and more of. I do not want to be doomed to an alcoholic death. And I know if I go out here tonight and take a drink, it may not happen tonight, but it's going to start that craving, and I'm going to drink more, and probably in the next couple of days or whenever, I don't know, I'm going to be dead or I'm going to be locked up. And it may not be because of the disease, like people get liver problems and stuff. It might be because somebody has killed me because I've done something under the influence, and it would look like, oh, that poor girl. But underneath it, it would probably be because I was drunk. And I don't want you to read about me in the paper. My life is good today. I have gotten married in sobriety that I was never married before. I've got a good job, a job that I never... I mean, I worked a job at an electronics company for 4 years, and the only thing that kept me in that seat was AA tapes and doing peace work. Even when I wanted to leave, I just kept listening, calling on the break, and staying in my seat. And I never worked a job in 4 years. And then when I got laid off from that, I looked into another field, and, you know, now I have a job as a realtor. Convicted felons don't get jobs as realtors. They don't get keys to offices when you've stolen and, you know, grand larceny and stuff like that. But it can happen, you know, and it's because I laid down the drink. I let y'all help me, and I believe that God has relieved me of that obsession because I've done some of the work in these pages. Do I got a lot more to do? I got a whole lot more to do, and I'm willing. As long as I stay willing and stay connected and have a sponsor and keep coming and talking to y'all and being available, I've got a chance. But once I stop doing those things, I don't know what's going to happen to me. And I really do have a good life today. And I've got good relationships with my son today and with people today. I don't struggle for a drink today. I might struggle in other areas with my mouth or little, you know, off the edge sometimes and stuff like that. But, you know, if I want that removed and I'm willing and I give it to God, then He's going to do that in His time, not in my time. You know, I believe in here real quick where it talks about we were 1,000 men and women just as hopeless as Bill. I've come to believe that I need to be just as hopeless as Bill here. If I'm not hopeless, I'm not going to. If I'm not hopeless and I'm not desperate and I still have ideas, then I'm going to need to do all those ideas. I'm going to need to drink every drop I got coming to me till I'm out of all ideas and I'm willing to ask somebody to help me in the way that you see fit. And I struggle with that a lot. That's why I'm on four sponsor right now. But I got somebody that's more high stronger than I am right now that I listen to. So it's okay. I mean, it's all right. We're all here to help each other. And I'm rattling on. But if you're ever up in Lynchburg, we got good meetings there. And I appreciate Lynn and Billy asking me to come here. And I just hope that if you're new, you know, you'll just keep coming and give this, you know, thing a chance. And I just want to thank y'all. Thanks.